says the source sheet, we have a lot to talk about today. This shiur is dedicated by Rose and her husband Andrew in memory of their close friend and colleague, Dr. Emery Burke Tzvi Ben Lipa, who passed away at the end of December. His neshama should have an aliyah. He should benefit from the tzedakah and from our learning. So last time, we started on the problem of Shlomo's marriages, specifically the fact that he marries the daughter of Paro, who is an Egyptian. We had talked about his wives converting to Judaism, as the Rambam says, but that doesn't solve the problem, because the Torah's prohibition against a marriage to an Egyptian isn't based on whether they convert to Judaism or not. It seems to be prohibited no matter what. So how are we to understand that? So one approach that we brought was to say that yes, as Ralbag says, Shlomo was wrong. And in fact, Hashem punishes him slash us for it. So we saw the Gemara in Brachos that says that Shlomo didn't do this. He didn't marry her until after Shimi ben Gera died, because Shimi was a mentor of his, something we've discussed already before. And that indicates that this was the wrong thing to do. The Gemara Nida says that Hashem's anger against the Beis HaMikdash begins the day it is built, based on a verse in Yirmiyahu chapter 32. And it's the Gemara traces that to this event. We saw the Gemara in Sanhedrin that talks about this event leading to a decline in the economy or to the formation of the city of Rome. So that's all one school of thought, is that yes, he married an Egyptian and he wasn't supposed to. Second approach, we started on last time, but we didn't finish it. I removed from the sheet the pieces of Abarbanel that we already covered. There was just so much there, and I figured you didn't really want to print out, you know, all that much. So what we started with last time, Abarbanel offered us ways to let Shlomo off the hook. Four different approaches. First approach was the Gemara, which we saw in Yevamos, Daf Ayin Zayin 77b, which says that when the Torah says that you're not supposed to marry it doesn't say that. It says, don't abhor an Egyptian. Their banim, to the third generation, can enter the congregation of God. So there is a view in the Gemara there that says their banim, meaning sons, are the ones who can only enter with the third generation, not their banot, their daughters. Their daughters are fine always. They don't have to wait for the third generation. So even though that view does not win the day in the Gemara in Yevamos, nonetheless, the author of the view has a tradition to that effect, states that he has a tradition to that effect, and maybe that's what Shlomo is working with. That was one justification. The second justification that Shlomo offers is really remarkable, that the prohibition was not three generations from an Egyptian, meaning that an Egyptian converts to Judaism and then they marry some, you know, Ammonite, Moabite, whatever, then their kid is a second generation, then their kid is a third generation, not like that at all. Rather, what it was saying is, from now, from when the Torah is speaking, three generations are prohibited. So in other words, Moshe's generation, then the next generation, then the next generation. In those three generations, those are the ones who are not allowed to marry into the Jewish people, because this is a punishment for the way that they harmed us in Egypt, but it doesn't continue in perpetuity. After that, bring them close to Hashem and have them marry in. That was the second justification. And then you get the third justification, and I didn't bring the verse again on the sheet, which is a mistake. I should have, because that would have made this more clear. It's what we stopped with last time. And that is, if you look carefully at the text that the Torah uses, you know what? I'm going to share screen with the text. It's only going to have the Hebrew, but at least it will be something for people. So I'm just sharing now my Bar Ilan CD-ROM, and I will open it to Devarim chapter 23, and this way we'll be able to see it. So we're looking at the verse that I'm going to highlight here, verses 8 and 9. So it says, Lo sisa'ev Adomi, don't abhor an Edomite, the descendants of Esav, Ki achicha hu, he is your brother. Lo sista eiv mitzri, don't abhor an Egyptian. Ki ger ha-yisa be'artzo, because you are a stranger in his land. And instead, banim asher yivaldu lehem dor shlishi yavo lehem b'kahal Hashem. Third generation can enter in. So Abarbanel, in his third approach, says that we're misreading the sentence. He says what it actually means is, don't abhor them, bring them close. The third generation especially should be brought close. So what he argues is, they can marry in from the beginning, their third generation should definitely join us. If you take a look at the sheet in the in source number one, the beginning of my English translation, I'm not going to read through the Hebrew, I would have said further, as per the simple text, he says, this is the simple read. The Torah did not prohibit Egyptians and Edomites from entering the community of God if they enter beneath the wings of the Shekhinah. And it did not say Edomites and Egyptians shall not enter the community of God the way it does for Ammon and Moab. And he says, and it did not prohibit seeking their welfare and benefit as it does with Ammon and Moab. But it commanded that we not abhor their descendants, since we lived as strangers in the lands of their ancestors. And even though it said, their children born to them, the third generation, shall enter into the community of God, this need not mean that the first and second generation may not enter the community, but that the third generation should enter positively as a commandment. And for the preceding generations, it will be optional. Moshe, I see your hand, but I'm going through this discussion and then I'm going to take comments and questions. Thanks. So that is Abarbanel's third approach. And then you get his fourth approach. And his fourth approach is, again, look at the biblical text. He says, entering into the kahal, entering into the community, may not mean what you think it means. It may not mean marriage. Continuing in my English translation, he says, who can tell us that marriage is, quote, entry into the community? I say that it is only that they should not be like Jews for all matters of honor and status, meaning they should not be officers over thousands and hundreds, Sanhedrin and courts. They shouldn't be put in charge of the community. And it said this because the divine desire is that the third generation should no longer be called stranger, but Israelite for all matters. And he said, how can we not say this? We find Edomites and Egyptians converted and married Jewish women and did not violate the law. He points out Ovadia is from Edom. He says the Erevrav, the Egyptians who came out of Egypt with the Jews, they married Jews, he claims. So his argument is that, of course, they're able to, they're able to marry in. This is Abarbanel's fourth justification. Clear? I rushed it a little bit, but are we somewhat clear? So Abarbanel is pretzeling himself, right? That's really what he's doing here. He flat out can't bring himself to say that Shlomo sinned with this, and for a very simple reason. The point that we made last week. The fact that we are told that Shlomo loves God. It says it right here, right after he marries the daughter of the Pharaoh. He walks in the ways of David, his father. It says that he's righteous, that God talks to him positively. In the rest of the chapter, he's going to have a dream and Hashem is going to promise him wonderful things. If marrying the daughter of the Pharaoh was wrong, then this whole chapter doesn't make sense. That's what drives Abarbanel on this. Clear? I'm not asking for comments just yet, but you were clear? Okay. Now I'm going to show you Abarbanel do something that I wish people would do more often, which is, after he has fully invested himself in saying the most outlandish things in order to defend his position, he then says, yeah, the problem is I'm overruled, so I'm going to have to go a different way. Take a look. He says, I'm going to go with the Hebrew and the English at this point. The Hebrew paragraph, you're looking at the third paragraph in source number one, Aval Chachameinu. The English will be the bottom paragraph on the first page. Aval Chachameinu zichronam livracha kiblu amitat hamitzvot ha-toriyot asher zacharti ba'ofen acher. He says, what am I supposed to do? Our sages have accepted the truth of the biblical mitzvot that I have mentioned in a different way. Meaning, I am saying you can reinterpret the commandment in all of these different ways, but that's not our tradition. Kiblu zal she'ador harishon v'asheni me'hamitzriyim asurim lavo v'kahal. He says their tradition that they accepted is that the first generation may not marry him. V'shehabia b'kahal te'omer al hanisuin v'achitun, and that entering the community means marriage. V'shehador ha'shlishi nimne l'chol mitkayer lo liyotzei Mitzrayim, and that the third generation means for every Egyptian who converts to Judaism. It doesn't mean Moshe's generation and two more. V'shebemitzriyim ne'amar banim asher yivadu lahem kolel l'zacharim l'nekevot. And when it says banim, it means all Egyptians, not just the males. And then he goes on to quote the Rambam to that effect. He says, it's a Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Daf Lamed Vav. It's a Rambam, Hilchos Yisuri, Bia, Hala, and Perek Yud Beis. He says, what am I supposed to do? And so he continues to say, this is, to me, very, very important as someone who reads a lot of Abarbanel. Hine, her isicha derech hachameinu zal be'inyan hazeh. He says, I've shown you the way of our sages in this matter. V'hu ha-mekubal v'ha-amiti. It is the accepted tradition, and it is the true tradition. V'lachein ro'oi sh'nivchar derech tshuvos ha-sfekos asher ha-irosi maskim le-kabalasam. So he says, I'm going to have to come up with another way to resolve the problems that I've raised. The problem of marrying someone you're not supposed to marry on the one hand, and on the other hand, saying that he is beloved to God and he loves God and so on. He says, I need another approach. He says, the problem that I have is that all those sages who said you're not supposed to marry an Egyptian didn't bother to explain how Shlomo did it. He says, you know, it's all well and good for them to tell me what the law is, but no one's justifying or explaining how to understand this. Now, mind you, Abarbanel is familiar with the work of Ralbag. So he knows Ralbag says Shlomo broke the law. But he's choosing not to bring that as a way to deal with the problem. So what's his solution? Va'omar, he said, I'll tell you what. Sheshlomo bameshi hischaten es paro melech Mitzrayim chata. When Shlomo marries with Paro, making this marriage, he sinned. Ki im hayos shegieres ishto kodem shalakacha. He says, yeah, he converted her. Hine liyosa mitzris kodem ador ashlishi haisa asura lavo v'kol ischaten ima. She is Egyptian before the third generation. He's not allowed to marry her. Ukvar amru chachamim zal shalakach nimsmach sipor shiri ben gera lachitun bas Paro. He says, that's why we saw this Gemara already. It's linked to the death of Shimi ben Gera, that he wouldn't have done this when Shimi was alive because it was the wrong thing to do. V'imkein l'da'atam chotei haya. So clearly they believe that he sinned in doing this. Aval l'da'ati, but in my view, b'chet oze shogeg haya b'dvar halacha. The answer is he was wrong, but it was an accident. Not an accident in the sense that he didn't know she was Egyptian. That's not what we're saying. But rather, he got the halacha wrong. Shechashav shachrei shekiyira lo haya alav asham v'yisam utaraslau. He thought that she could convert. He thought conversion was sufficient. Mitzuraf lezeh shalot ischatei makim lahashlim malchuso ba'avur paro melech Mitzrayim shakarov elav. Especially because this wasn't really a marriage. Right? We've said this before. I think Moish said it last week. This isn't to be viewed as a marriage relationship with all of the overtones and concerns about marrying an Egyptian and absorbing their culture and whatnot. This was a political marriage for the sake of creating peace with the big gorilla that is your neighbor Egypt. He says, Kamosha Marti, as I said in the beginning, Velo me'avas bito, he's not doing it in order to marry, because he loves the daughter of the Pharaoh. V'lihyos kavanaso ritsuya ka'asher lekacha. And because his intentions were desirable in marrying her, Amar HaKasuv, Vayehav Shlomo as Hashem, Lelechas b'chukos David Aviv. The text says, he loved Hashem, because he did, to go in the path of his father David. V'lo nismach osa pasuk ipur achitun, ki im lahodia shemachsheva Shlomo hisa zaka uberura v'sha'asa zeh b'tom levavo. He says, that's exactly why the text says he loved God, right here, in order to teach me that yes, his marriage was wrong, and yes, he loved God. it's teaching me both of those points by juxtaposing them. And it continues to say, Kihu ohevayas Hashem, he loved God, he wanted to follow his father's ways, ulaze amar. And he says, that's why the text is going to continue to say, rak babamotu mizabeach, only he loves God, but he's bringing sacrifices to God on scattered altars. Kibazelavad hayodeya shaya osa shaloka hogan. That's where he was doing something that was wrong, and he knew it. Not marrying the daughter of the Pharaoh, in that he didn't think that he was doing anything wrong. And therefore, Bar Vidal continues to say, I don't want to eat up too much time with this, so I'm just going to sum up. Therefore, Hashem did not rebuke him for having taken her. And also, by the way, we said Shlomo was really young at this time. We had some discussion about that. Young was Shlomo. Nonetheless, he said Shlomo was young. And he says, I will show you that his intentions were good. Last point. He says, we're going to have to get to this later on in the text, but he brings it here. In Divrei Hayamim Aleph Perek Chet, we are told that Shlomo builds a special house for the daughter of Paro. After Beis HaMikdash is built, after his palace is built, he's going to give her own space outside of Ir David. And his reason for that is because this is a consecrated place. It's the place where the Aron is, and therefore the daughter of the Pharaoh should not be there. And in fact, he says, Lo teshev li isha. He's not going to have any wife of his in that place. And therefore, he says, I'm going to have a place elsewhere. So Abarbanel says, well, that shows that his intentions are with God. He's thinking about God. Otherwise, he wouldn't have had this concern. And therefore, he merits to gain prophecy later in this chapter, and that's something we have to talk more about. But fundamentally, Abarbanel's answer is, first to say, Shlomo wasn't wrong, we can rewrite the prohibition, and all the pilpulim and different ways he tries to come up to make this all fit. And then he backs down, and he says, yeah, but I had to walk away from all of that, it was fun, I'm going to keep it in my book. They paid Abarbanel by the word. But I'm going to walk it all back and say the answer is yes, what he did was wrong. But it was a mistake. It was shogeg. It wasn't something where he was trying to thwart God's will. It was it was an error in understanding what the law should be. Okay, Moish, thank you for waiting. What do you have for me?
Sorry, that was a mistake. I didn't get that.
Oh, okay. Yes, Ricky. Ricky and then Sandra.
What is the name of Abarbanel's book while he writes some of these commentaries?
This is just his commentary on Tanakh. That's all. There's no special name.
Where is it written? Is there?
Right, so no. I mean, if you wanted to get it, it is sold as a standalone. I even think that there is a translation of his commentary to Chumash, although not, I think, to Tanakh as a whole. You'd have to look online. I'm not familiar with it. I think it exists. But this is just like if you went into a Chanut Sfarim, right? You went into a Sfarim store and wanted to buy it, you would say, Perusha Barbanel al HaTorah. That's what you would call it. There are unique names that he gives to some parts of his commentary. So on Daniel, it's called either Mashmiya Yeshua or Yeshua Mishicha. I forget which one is his commentary to Daniel. But I think it's Mashmiya Yeshua. But generally speaking, you ask for a Barbanel's commentary to the Torah.
So where is this commentary come in? What context, physically, in what context does it come? Where is the context of his writing? If it's like in one body of writing, where is it actually?
It's a standalone book.
So he wrote this book about the...
No, wait, Ricky, are you asking where it's available today or where he wrote it?
No, I'm asking if he wrote this as one book or
no.
These commentaries come in somebody else's writing.
He wrote this over time. We've talked about this, but it's a while ago. It's worth reiterating. Abarbanel wrote his commentaries to Tanakh over time. Some of them were written before the expulsion from Spain, and some of them only afterwards. He did not write it in order. It's not like he starts with Yoshua and then works his way through. They're actually done out of order, and I don't remember at this point whether his commentary for Malachim was one of the earlier ones or the later ones. I'm not sure.
He told us from one of our last classes when he was in Venice.
So, when he did a lot of writing there.
Correct.
And he finally came back, right? And I think he's actually buried in Italy.
Right. So what happened was when he was in Spain, he was very close with the government. He did not have as much time for writing. And post-expulsion, he devoted more time for his writing. That's correct.
Was this in response to some other people's writing?
No.
Or is it just something he sat down to write?
So he wrote this on his own as his own publication of Torah. He is, in some of it, responding to events from his time, in particular the loss of hope that the Jews experienced when they were expelled. So that's there as well. What I would suggest is I gave classes about Abarbanel in a couple of series, including one that I did in the Wednesday morning series last year. If you go to YU Torah and search for Torchina or Abarbanel or something like that, you'll find it. And we had more discussion there about it.
Wrote about the Spanish thinkers, you talked about it.
Yeah.
That was there.
Okay, I've done it in a couple of different contexts. Sandra?
I'm just a little bit, not confused, but the Torah differentiates between Edom and Amalek.
Yes.
Amaleki, can they marry into Jewish people?
Yes. Someone from Amalek is able to convert to Judaism, is able to marry a Jew, 100%. There is no prohibition against converting any member of Amalek.
So does the prohibition about remembering the Hashem son of Amalek?
So that's a national, prohibition. However, in the event that any member of Amalek agrees to accept the 7 Noahide laws, then they can continue to live as a non-Jew in Israel. There is no mitzvah of destroying them. And in the event that they choose to accept Judaism on the whole, then they can convert to Judaism. The Gemara in Gittin talks about Haman and says that descendants of Haman learned Torah or taught Torah in Bnei Brak. They convert to Judaism. And Haman is Amaleki as anybody we ever think about. The Rambam writes this. What I said to you about them choosing to live in Israel, if they accept the Noahide laws, the Rambam brings that as halach. I think it's in Hilchos Malachim, if I remember correctly. So yes, they are able to. Amalek and Edom are two different things. I mean, they're the same in the sense that Amalek, the original Amalek, is Esav's grandson. So Edom represents the body of their descendants who lived in the southeast, basically. They lived south in Israel and east of the Yarden. It doesn't represent, though, all of them, Amalek being its own identity. Gita.
Thank you.
Yeah. You have to unmute.
This is probably a naive question, but how far can someone push in halakha today to say, well, I do love Hashem, I love God, really do, but I've done this? I mean, how much can you push that?
You can't. You can't. Meaning, there is no license in halacha for somebody to say, I love God and I'm going to break his rules. That doesn't work. It works as an argument for tshuva. I love God, I feel terrible about what I've done after the fact. It does not work to ask permission in advance and say, well, God, I really love you, so let me do this. That's not an option. What Abarbanel is arguing when he says that Shlomo loves God is not, and therefore it's okay, it's just to him a demonstration of Shlomo's positive intent, which to him indicates Shlomo wouldn't have done this if he knew it was wrong. He loves God. He only did it because he thought that it was okay.
Wow.
That's what he's arguing. He's absolutely not arguing that Shlomo justified it, saying, well, I love God, so I can do whatever I want. Okay. So that's in terms of Shlomo's marriage to the daughter of Paro. A couple of smaller notes that I didn't want to miss before we get into the very big issue of Shlomo's vision of God and his the gift of wisdom and all that. First of all, the following, really, I should have done this back in chapter 2, sentence 10. If you go back to chapter 2, sentence 10, we were told that David passed away, and he was buried in Ir David. So I was really focused when we did chapter 2 on Shlomo's consolidation of power, David's instructions and Shlomo's way of dealing with Adoniyahu and with Abiatar and all of that. So I didn't talk about this then. But Ir David comes back in chapter 3, sentence 1, where we're told that he brought the daughter of the Pharaoh to Ir David. So years and years ago, there was a debate published in Jewish Action, the OU's magazine, between Rabbi Ari Zivotofsky and Rabbi Label, something like Kushnick. I'm not sure 100%. I don't remember exactly what his last name was. But I gave you links to the two articles in source number 2. They went back and forth regarding the question of where is Ir David? What is this place that we call Ir David? In Shmuel Bet, chapter 5, we say that it was a Yebusi fortress called Mitzudat Tzion. In Malachim, if you look for a second ahead at chapter 8, sentence 1, you will see there a description of Ir David, Hi Tzion. Ir David is Tzion. That's the statement. Ir David is the place we saw where David is buried. It's where Shlomo is going to be buried in chapter 11. It's where later kings of Yehuda will be buried in chapter 14, chapter 15, chapter 22, and then further in Malachim Bet. Out of the 21 kings of Yehuda, Tanakh uses similar phraseology regarding the burial of the first 15 kings, indicating all of them are buried in this place, Ir David. We also find it, interestingly, for Yehoyada, the Kohen Gadol, who was acting king for a period of time. Those of you who did Ezra Nehemiah with me may remember that in Nehemiah chapter 3, when they're working on the wall of Yerushalayim, and they're building the Beis Hamikdash, actually it's during the building of the Beis Hamikdash, or is it? No, I think it's during the wall. I think it's when they're building the wall of Yerushalayim. They mention a site there as the place where David was buried. So this was a familiar place in Tanakh. Post-Tanakh, we continue to find references to it. Josephus talks about it. He records that Yochanan Hyrcanus opened one of the tombs of the kings of the Davidic line and he looted it. Herod opened the second tomb and tried to loot it as well, and then he built a monument on top of the tombs because he felt bad and because he was Herod and he builds things. The point is, though, they have a continued identification of the place where the kings of David's line are buried, this Ir David. But then our record jumps. And again, I'm working basically from those two articles. It's not something I've done my own independent research on. But the next record that I think we have is in the 12th century. If you've heard of Binyamin of Tudela, famous traveler from that period of time, and he relates that in his stay in Yerushalayim, he heard a story about the rediscovery of the tomb of David HaMelech. And you have heard versions of this story. Two Jewish workers were employed by the Christian patriarch to reconstruct a damaged monument on Har Zion, on Mount Zion. They come across a secret passage. They go into the passage. You've heard stuff like this? They go into the passage and they find themselves in a palace with marble columns, a table with a golden scepter on it, a golden crown on it. This is very Crusades. With riches all around. And the workers decide, well, this must be the tomb of King David. And then they're struck down by a fierce wind and they hear voices telling them to leave immediately. They're not killed by the wind or they wouldn't have heard the voices. But they're knocked down, and then they flee, and then 3 days later, the workmen are sick in bed and will not go back to the site. They're so traumatized by what they saw. 15th century, there was actually an attempt made by Jews to buy the location from the Franciscans. They did not succeed, but the Muslims succeeded in taking it from the Franciscans. And during that period of Muslim control, Jews would go to the site that they believed to be Ir David, the tomb of David, every year for Shavuos. Because Shavuos is the yard site of David HaMelech by tradition. In the middle of the 19th century, the Turkish city engineer of Yerushalayim reported finding a labyrinth of caves underneath the site that was believed to be King David's tomb. So with all of these, you know, reports, it's very tempting to say the place we know of as Ir David, the place we call Ir David today, the city of David today, is going to be the same place it was back then because we've been keeping track. But you do have that 1,000-year gap between Josephus and Binyamin of Tudela, and honestly, his report, not so compelling as a matter of, it's not a dry historical document, that's for sure. So there are three different options for this place. And I was going to bring you a map, and then I couldn't find the map, and I couldn't fit it on the page. But you basically have, well, first of all, there's an area in Yerushalayim that's just north of the old city called the Tombs of the Kings. However, it doesn't make any sense in terms of history to think that that's it. It's generally assumed not to be it. It might be considered to be from the Hellenistic period, and they could have had royalty buried there. The two sites that are more realistic, if you can envision the map of Har Habayit, if you can picture the Temple Mount and the Old City and that region. So there is a western hill and there is an eastern hill. So one view is that it's on the western hill. There's a cenotaph there that was built by the Crusaders and has been considered since then the Har Tzion site. And Har Tzion is Ir David. However, the other argument is the southeastern part of the old city, south of Har Habayit, the Temple Mount, which is what today people often call Ir David, the city of David. It's actually part of a national park, and that's the site they call Ir David. So it's either on the western hill, or it's what today is called Ir David. The articles, I recommend reading them, especially for people who like this kind of thing. They talk about issues like which areas would likely have been settled back in those days based on where the water supplies are. So it's interesting and possibly worth your time for a quick read. I just wanted to at least note we have some confusion about where Ir David is. So that's worth knowing. Okay, comments on that? Anybody want to tell me they descended into the area of the tombs and they heard a voice and the wind and no? Okay. Yeah, Janine and then Ricky.
Just wondering. So you're saying that probable but not for sure that where the site of Ir David today really is Ir David. I mean, they made a whole project out of it.
Right. It's,
it may not be there.
But. Right. So it's definitely a candidate for it, but it's not the only candidate. That's what I would say. It's definitely a candidate. There's reason for it, but it's not the only one. Ricky.
There's some construction going on in my building, so I missed that. I missed the part that you said would be interesting to look into.
That's what I think. If you're interested in the topic, take a look at those two articles. That's all I'm saying.
Are they in the?
They're on the source sheet. They're linked on the source sheet.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay. I want to also talk now about a few other just small things, but important things, including Shlomo's second weakness. So if you open up chapter 3, sentences 1 to 3. Okay, this is where we first read about Shlomo making a wedding with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, marrying the daughter of the Pharaoh, bringing her to the city of David. Right? So, a few things here. First of all, look at the order of what he built. He brought her to the city of David, ad kaloso, until he completed, or before he completed, libnos es beiso, to build his house, vies beis Hashem, and the house of God, vies chomas Yerushalayim saviv, and to build the wall of Yerushalayim around it. So it sounds like he at chapter 3, sentence 1, still the same. So this seems to highlight a serious character flaw, right? You build your house before you build the house of God. A chutzpah. Right? By what right does Shlomo do that? The problem is that it's not true. Jump ahead, please, to chapter 5, sentence 16. In chapter 5, sentence 16, we find Shlomo send a message to Hiram. This is before Shlomo has built his own palace. He sends a message to Hiram, king of Tsor, Tyre, up in Lebanon, saying to him, you know, my father wanted to build this house and he couldn't do it. He was surrounded by wars. And now I would like to be the one to go build the Beis HaMikdash, to build the temple. Fast forward to chapter 6, sentence 1. And we are told, in the 480th year from when the Jews left Egypt, the fourth year of the reign of Solomon, the month of Ziv, which is Iyar, the second month of the calendar, that the fourth year from when Shlomo reigned over Israel, he built the house of God. So Shlomo is building the Beis HaMikdash, he's building the temple at this stage, in his fourth year. Remember we talked about how you read the first chapter linearly? Like the first chapter records the consolidation of Shlomo's reign, culminating in the death of Shimi ben Gera after 3 years. And then you hit your next chapter, and Shlomo is already building the temple. He's building the Beis HaMikdash, and chapter 6 is going to give us a lot of details. And then you jump to chapter 6, sentence 37, where it reiterates, it's the fourth year of his reign, and the house is established in Yerach Ziv, the month of Ziv, Iyar, that month. And then we're told that in the 11th year, the month of Bul, which is Cheshvan, it is the 8th month on the calendar, Kala Habayit L'chol Devarav L'chol Mishpatav, the house is complete, so it's a roughly 7-year process for the construction, Vayivneyu Sheva Shanim, in case you couldn't do the math. He built it in 7 years, the text says. And then in chapter 7, sentence 1, it says that Shlomo built his own house for 13 years. The commentators assume this is sequential. 7 years first for this building project, 13 years for the next building project. Which makes sense, because jump now to chapter 9, sentence 10. Almost all these verses are referenced in source number 3 on your sheet. So jump to chapter 9, sentence 10, in which we are told, hang on, it was after 20 years when Shlomo built the two houses. In other words, it is indeed in sequence. 7 for the Beis HaMikdash, 13 for his own palace, right? The Medrash in Shir HaShirim Rabbah, we'll talk about it, I expect, when we get further along in Malachim, but the Medrash actually says there are two ways to read the fact that his house took 13 years and the Beit HaMikdash took 7, right? Either that's a statement of criticism. His house was more elaborate. He spends 13 years building his house, only 7 for the Beit HaMikdash. Or it's praise for him. He was energetic about building the Beis HaMikdash. He got the contractors to move on it for his own house, you know, whenever the contractors get around to it. We've dealt with contractors. We know what that's like. I want to talk about that Medrash more when we get later on in Malachim. But the point here is the text presents Shlomo as building his house before he builds the Beis HaMikdash. But in practice, it's not true. So my question now, which I will put to you, is why is it recorded out of order? We have to make him look bad? Yeah, Moish. Yeah, you're muted.
I don't know whether you're going to have time for the whole story.
I don't want the whole story.
So in short... Shlomo makes an alliance with the Pharaoh because all these skilled artisans, the architects, all these great people...
One second, Moish, hang on. Are you answering the question or are you on a different point?
No, I'm answering it exactly.
Okay, go ahead.
So the alliance is to bring these artisans to Israel because all these artisans have been for centuries in Egypt because that's where their work is desired. Shlomo tells Pharaoh something other different than what he's actually going to use the artisans for.
What are you drawing on here?
Pardon?
What are you drawing on here? Meaning, we get lots of description in the text of where the artisans come from. No one ever mentions they're coming from Egypt. They're generally Lebanese.
I say hockey players come from Canada, or from Russia, or America. No, seriously, I'm being serious.
But it's not, because we're told where they come from. They come from Lebanon. Like, we get explicit discussion.
That's just the cedar guys. That's just the cedar guys.
No, it's not.
The artisans come from Egypt.
So,
I mean, hold on, you know where the pyramids are from. These guys built the pyramids and all the graves.
The pyramids are way before this story. Like long before this story, the pyramids. But even if you accept that, what does it have to do with listing his construction of the Beis HaMikdash and his own palace out of order?
Because he is deceiving Paro as to how long he wants these workers. There's an alliance just to bring the workers. That's why the daughter comes, because she's going to be their consul when they get into trouble. You need a consul for people get drunk in all the bars. No, I'm serious.
Okay, Moish.
I'm sorry. You're laughing.
You don't need to apologize at all. It's
a better explanation than any other explanation.
We haven't said any other explanation yet. How do you know it's better?
No, but there isn't a better explanation.
Okay, Moish, I'm going to go to the next person. I'm sorry. I got him. Janine, go ahead, and then Chana.
Maybe it's talking in terms of Bat Paro, where he... I don't know where his house was, because I'm a little confused at whether that was in Ir David. His home was in Ir David, but he left her in Ir David till he finished building a house for her, and then built...
Oh, so yeah, no, it doesn't work. His house is in Ir David. She's going to go in a separate house. If you look at the pasuk I referenced from, that Abarbanel brought from Divrei HaYamim, you'll see. That's a separate house. That's not his palace.
Well, maybe it's talking about the house that he built in order to put her in there.
But because here it talks about Beito, and then it's going to say he finishes building Beito, and then he builds this other place for her. Ad kaloto, Lubno says Beito. Yeah, and I'm sorry. I don't think it works. Chana, you're muted.
Not sure it's a good reason, but with his house, we just mentioned previous house, no details. Beis HaMikdash, she goes into a lot of details. Here, there's a lot of details, so to make it one unit, it's mentioned after, because of all the details that's coming after.
But we're going to have a large gap between here and we get to those details.
That's
good. Yeah, I'd have a hard time with that. I mean, this is a hard sentence to work with. It just is. Radak, I think, is trying to make this work when he suggests that you read... I think this is what Radak is saying, that the way to read it is, he brought her to Ir David after he built his house, which was after he built the house of God. So, Ad Kaloto Levnodet Beito, which was after Beit Hashem. But that doesn't work. Because what about Chomat Yerushalayim? Right? Chomat Yerushalayim wasn't done earlier. I mean, we haven't seen any reference to it. I don't think that that's really such a great read either. I would wonder if the answer is not that this is a criticism, along with his marriage to Bat Paro, which, after all, is in the same sentence. This is a loaded, loaded sentence. And what it's saying is, he may do it in the right order, but his heart is in the wrong order. In practice, he's going to end up doing it in the right order. It's true. He's going to build the Beis HaMikdash first, and then he's going to build his own palace. However, by making a marriage with the daughter of Paro and bringing her to Ir David, we are saying that it's as though he put his own house before the Beis HaMikdash. It's a suggestion. It's definitely not the only way, but so far I have not heard a way to read this that was satisfactory. Sandra and then Moish.
I was just wondering, where did David live?
So David is not in Yerushalayim. David is not, I mean, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that. He is in Yerushalayim, but he doesn't have the site of the Beis HaMikdash. Well, let's say it this way. David is king in Hebron for 7 years, and then he is king in Yerushalayim for 33 years. That we do have. Without going into the
second. We have a house, and yeah. I was just wondering whether, if he did have a house in Yerushalayim, and Shlomo inherited everything that David had, could he have used David's house as his own, and then the order is a little bit different?
So he definitely uses it, well, not definitely, I think he uses it as his own until his house is done. Like, he's got to live somewhere. So I assume he's living in the house of David until then. But the problem with using that for Beito in this sentence is it says, Livnot et Beito v'et Beit Hashem, to build his house. Right? That's where I'm stuck. Moish.
Yeah. This is not as good as my usual eloquence, but isn't it something simple? He started working on the palace, stopped, built a Beit HaMikdash, and then finished.
Yeah, the problem is that the text says explicitly that only after the Beis HaMikdash was established, was completed, did he start on the other project. Like, did you see the psukim that we read aloud? Do you have a Tanakh with you? So, like, it really does seem to make it pretty clear that this is the way it goes. It's hard to read it another way. I don't know if people hear the construction noise in the background here. I apologize if it's coming through. Ricky and I are in different buildings, but we both have construction going on in the background. Joyce, you were going to say?
Would Shlomo have children at this point?
Would Shlomo have children?
Children at this point.
So the first marriage of Shlomo we know about is the daughter of Paro, and we don't get any information about his children.
So didn't David say he had to have a dynasty before he built the temple?
I don't remember him saying that, no. No. David wants to build the temple, and Natan tells him he's not allowed to. And when we get further along, and Shlomo talks about building it and how David couldn't build it, we're going to analyze. There are multiple reasons given in Tanakh for why David is not able to build it. But I don't think one of them is the lack of a dynasty yet. I don't think so. Yeah. Okay. So that was just something I wanted to note here. This order is funny, and I think it's trying to say something, and I haven't really got what I consider a complete understanding of it. Second point I wanted to note, the wall of Yerushalayim. We mentioned in this sentence, in sentence one there, Chomat Yerushalayim Saviv, the wall of Jerusalem around the city. So I brought you on the sheet, Ralbag, in source number 4. He says, building this wall is not only a matter of defense, right? Naturally, I think of a wall as a defensive wall. But it also has halachic significance. He says, Hine haya ra'oi livnos choma saviv Yerushalayim l'kadesh masha besocha. It was appropriate to build a wall around Jerusalem to consecrate what was within the wall. Ki harbe min hakadoshim lo hayu ne'achalim ki im lifnim min hachoma achar shenivne beis Hashem sham. He says, there were holy items that you were not allowed to eat outside of the boundaries of Yerushalayim, outside of the wall, once the Beis HaMikdash was built there. If you ever want to know more about this, if you look at the first chapter in the Mishnayos Kalim, it talks about the 10 areas of sanctity in Yerushalayim. The wall of Yerushalayim is critical for consecrating that which is within. Those of you who were there when we learned Ezra and Nehemiah, we discussed this a little bit in the beginning of Nehemiah when he builds the wall in his day. And he gives you examples here in Ralbag of some of the things that you had to eat in Yerushalayim. The Bikurim, the first fruits, right, has to be. Carbon Pesach has to be eaten there. So you need that wall for halachic purposes. So I'm just noting that here. But now I want to note the biggest point within these verses. Take a look at sentence 3. Sentence 2 is going to be starting in sentence 2. Rock only, and this is what Abarbanel noted, we're about to introduce where he's not doing something right. Rock ha'am mizavachim babamot. They were sacrificing on altars. Kilo nivna bayis l'shem Hashem arayamim ha'em. Because there was no Beis HaMikdash until that point. Meaning, the Mishkan at this point is in Giv'on. It is makeshift. It's not, what they're meant to remain with. It's there after Shaul destroys the city of Nov. And then we're told, as we said before, Vayehav Shlomo es Hashem. Shlomo loved God. Laleches bechukos David Aviv, walking in the ways of his father. David rak babamos hu mizabeach umaktir. We get our second rock. But he's using these altars. Now, these are altars for God. Let's be clear. This is not idolatry. However, he's not using the Mishkan in Givon, and he's not building a Beis HaMikdash. He's using these altars instead. And that brings me to sentence four. Vayelech HaMelech Givona. The king went to Givon, Lizboach Sham, to bring sacrifices there, ki hi ha-bama ha-gedola, because that was the great big altar. Elef Olos, 1,000 burnt offerings, Yaaleh Shlomo al Mizbeach, Shlomo brought on that Mizbeach, on that altar. Okay, there's a lot to talk about. We got 8 minutes, so we're going to get started on this. He is using Bamot. Only he is using Bamot. And he went to Givon to bring sacrifices. So the fact that it says only, he loved God, he did the things that his father did, only, indicates that use of the Bamot was a bad thing. It was a detraction from his general good conduct. So what was wrong with using these Bamot? At the end of the day, you're sacrificing to God, number one. Number two, Bamot were 100% legal. Let's be very clear. The last chapter in Zvachim gives us the rundown of when you were allowed to use private altars and when you were not. When the Mishkan stood in Shiloh, you were not allowed to have private altars. After Shiloh, go for it. Until the construction of the Beis HaMikdash. When the Mishkan was in Nov, Mishkan was in Givon, no problem. Consider, Shmuel, right, brought sacrifices on Bamot, on minor altars. Remember when Shaul first met Shmuel? In, I think it's the 9th chapter of Shmuel Aleph. So, bless you. So on that occasion, Shmuel is bringing a sacrifice in some town. That's what he did. Shaul brought offerings on minor altars. Remember before the war, he was supposed to bring offerings with Shmuel. He didn't wait for Shmuel. We have that. So what is wrong with Shlomo doing something that is fundamentally legal? Like, I understand we don't want him marrying an Egyptian because that's against the law. But what's wrong with him bringing offerings like this? So I'm going to show you two approaches. First approach is Rashi's approach. The criticism of Shlomo is because he didn't build the Beis HaMikdash yet. Now, you'll say to me, okay, but he's getting around to it. But it's important to understand, and in some ways this should have been in our introduction to Malachim, and I did reference it a little bit there, but it only makes sense once you see this. I gave you a whole bunch of references in source number 6 to passages from Shmuel Bet and Divrei Hayamim. If you do not have a Tanakh with you, you will hear it because I'm going to say them. I'm going to recite them, but you can follow along on the sheet in source number 6. If you have a Tanakh, that would certainly be better so that you see it for yourself. So Shmuel Bet, chapter 7. Sentence 13 is our first stop. This is when David said, I want to build a temple, I want to build a Beis HaMikdash, and he's not allowed to. Nasan the Navi says to David, you're going to have a son, and now in chapter 7 in Shmuel Bet, he is going to build a house in my name, and I'm going to establish his throne forever, I will be a father for him, he will be a son. He does things wrong, I'm going to rebuke him. My kindness will never leave him. Your house will be established, your family will be established forever. But it starts with, your son is going to build a temple. Your son is going to build a Beis HaMikdash. Got it? That's number one. Now jump to chapter 8, sentence 7. Look what David does. David takes gold, right? You see that? David takes gold that they've captured, and he dedicates it. He consecrates it for God. He's going to do the same thing in sentence 8 with copper. He's going to designate it for God. All the way through to sentence 11 here, he dedicates materials, silver, gold, copper, for the temple, for the Beis HaMikdash. Then jump ahead, in still in Shmuel Bet, chapter 24, sentence 18, we're at the end of the book. And here you find that the prophet God comes to David and tells him to establish an altar in the granary of Aravna, the Yebusite, the Jebusite. He goes to Aravna, right? He buys the site. There's a whole thing about him buying the site. That's its own story. But he buys the site and he builds an altar. He has bought the place where the Beis HaMikdash is going to be. This also appears in Divrei HaYamim Aleph, chapter 21. Then jump to Divrei HaYamim Aleph, please. Chronicles 1, chapter 22. After David has purchased the site for the Beis HaMikdash, we then get a whole other description which doesn't appear in Shmuel. Chronicles 1, chapter 22. Here we are told that not only did David buy the site, David makes he directs Shlomo, first of all, regarding construction of the Beis HaMikdash. That's what I want you to do, he tells his son. And he directs everybody about this. He tells them all about this. At the end of that chapter, chapter 22, he does a big public address to all the leaders of Israel, telling them, you shall help Shlomo to build the Beis HaMikdash. And then in chapters 23 to 29, and we're not reading them out, but you can see for yourself, David will assign workers, divided people up into shifts, all very public. Everybody in the entire nation knows Shlomo is supposed to build the Beis HaMikdash. Against this backdrop, in which David spends the last years of his reign getting everything in order so that Shlomo is able to build the Beis HaMikdash, and by the way, this really adds depth to Adoniyahu's coup. Because now it's very clear everybody knew Shlomo was supposed to be in charge, right? With all of this under our belt, we now understand what exactly Adoniyahu was fighting against when he did this. So the point here though is, Shlomo comes into office with a basic job. Build the temple. David told you to. He gave you the materials. He gave you the manpower. He gave you the directions. He told the entire nation, and you're sitting there and twiddling your thumbs for 4 years, bringing offerings to God on private altars? How dare you, Shlomo, right? That's why this is a criticism. He had no business stalling. That's Rashi's approach. The other approach that I've seen is brought by Radak and Abarbanel, and they make a different point. If you take a look on your sheet in source number 8, Radak says, I'm going to read out my English because we only have a minute to go. He says, why does it say only? They're permitted. Actually, I'm going to sum it up because there is no time. He says, the problem is that bringing sacrifices on minor altars encourages idolatry. Everyone builds their own altar to their own deity and they can get away with anything and it's not centralized. And that's the concern. I'm going to come back to this. I wasted too much on that, so that we'll come back to, God willing, next time. But what I hope we got from today is, first of all, Abarbanel's two approaches to Shlomo's marriage to the daughter of the Pharaoh. Besides the approach that says he sinned, we have two other ideas. Either that he was actually right, or after Abarbanel recants, he's wrong, but it was shogeg, it was based on a mistake. Ir David, there is a debate as to where this place Ir David is. See those articles for more on it. And we now get Shlomo's second weakness after marrying the daughter of Paro, which is either the fact that he hasn't built the Beis HaMikdash yet, or alternatively, the fact that he's using small altars instead of using the Mishkan. More to be seen on this, God willing, next week. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi.